Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in from Mike Collins. Today, we're talking baseball. Here we are in September. While many Americans foolishly devolve into football mode this time of year, the humbly enlightened among us know that this is when we must push aside all of life's silly distractions, football, Congress, your family, and focus on the stretch run to October baseball. But lest we lapse, or worse, run into a rain delay, sports writer Joe Posnanski has tossed us a fresh lifeline from the literary bullpen. It's called Why We Love Baseball, A History in 50 Moments. And, like a seasoned shortstop deploying phantom tags, Posnanski expands his roster with intermittent asides, supplementary countdowns such as five loud home runs, for example, and by cramming multiple episodes into what he counts as single moments. Indeed, Joe's math comes with the same ironclad reliability, not you, Cal, as a Little League World Series birth certificate. No matter, Joe can get away with all of this and more because he joyfully recounts moments both instantly familiar and delightfully obscure. He even throws in a TWIB reference, as in This Week in Baseball, the glorious MLB highlight show of the 1980s. An opening anecdote about spitball practitioner Gaylord Perry and the moon landing, yes, you heard right, the moon landing, make up for the absence of, for example, Johnny Bench's The Baseball Bunch. Well, almost. There's no need for me to continue with this baseball chatter. Instead, we will go to the source himself, who happens to be a Charlotte resident. Joe Posnanski, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
It is great to be here.
So as I mentioned, the book contains roughly 50 seminal moments in baseball history. And actually, I think you copped to 108 while noting that the Cubs championship drought numbered 108 years, among other things. But that's my roundabout way of asking, where did you get the idea and how hard was it for you to narrow your list?
Well, you could not have nailed it more. There's no easier way to narrow a list down to 50 moments than by putting actually 108 moments into the book. That's the easiest way to do that. So this one was, you know, this is my seventh book, and this is the first book that I've written where I started with the title. I actually had the title before I started. I knew it was going to be called Why We Love Baseball before I even knew what it was going to be about. The idea to me, as you so eloquently put in the lead up, is we love this crazy game after 150 years. And there's just nothing that goes back to the 19th century that's still so much a part of American life is baseball. And I wanted to really explore that. And I've written a lot about baseball. I love the game so much. And I really wanted to explore that idea. And what it ended up coming down to for me was moments. I think that's why we love baseball, or at least certainly a big part of it, are these moments, personal moments, special moments, historic moments, but silly moments. And so I wanted to come up with a list of these great moments. And I did pretty much kind of what I did when I wrote the Baseball 100, which was a countdown of the 100 greatest players. I started by writing down as many moments as I could think of in the same way that I did with the baseball players. And I came up with lots and lots and lots of moments. And then it came down to narrowing it down. And the guide that I used for narrowing it down was the title. Every moment I looked at it and said, okay, does this moment explain why we love baseball? And it was surprising to me how many sort of famous moments didn't really quite fit that, and how many ridiculous, funny, touching moments totally did. And so there are moments that people are going to see are not in this book, while at the same time they're going to see the moment where a baseball conked off the head of Jose Canseco and bounced off the wall, right? So it's because I was really guided and driven by this idea of what is it about this game that makes us love it so much?
And as you mentioned, you had done a book about the, I think it was the 100 greatest players, right?
That's
the name
right.
of the book, so I should be able to get that number right. And now you come to the 50 moments, and you just mentioned that there were a lot of famous moments that just didn't quite fit. What were a few that surprised you as you thought about them and say, gosh, you know what? It's not going to make the cut.
Well, there were just a lot of play. Here was a starting point for me. There are a lot of home runs in this book. And obviously home runs are exciting, pivotal part of baseball. But I didn't want this book to be nothing but home runs, right? And you, it was very easy to get that way. If you look at lists where people say the greatest moments in baseball history, a shocking percentage of them are home runs. And a home run is a part of baseball, of course, a big part. There are very famous home runs in here. As you mentioned, I have a whole section just that I call loud home runs. But they're not everything. And so there are home runs that won games and won pennants and all of that, that are not in this book. And there are many that are in this book. I mean, it's not like you were going to do a book like this and not have Bill Mazeroski's home run or Joe Carter's home run or whatever. But there are a lot that are not in this book. There is one moment in here, and you as a baseball fan probably really appreciate this. And this is one that is, I think you have to go a little bit deep as a baseball fan to fully appreciate. But there is a very famous catch made by Al Gianfrido in the World Series. And it was off of a long fly ball by Joe DiMaggio. And the reason the catch is so famous, in addition to being in a World Series and being a great catch, is that we have footage of it, Joe DiMaggio kicking the dirt after he hit the ball, after the ball was caught. And Joe DiMaggio was so famously unemotional on the field. He was very, he just never let anybody inside what he was thinking. And so that is a legendary moment, him kicking the dirt and expressing frustration. I was not going to include that moment in the book. And the reason I wasn't going to include that moment is I've seen the play many, many times. You can go on YouTube right now and look up Al Gianfrido or Joe DiMaggio kicking dirt or whatever, and you'll see the play. And it's just not that good a catch. I mean, I just could not get around the fact he's kind of stumbling around. The ball is not that close to the fence. It was not going to be a home run. It just is not that good a catch. And I was not going to include that moment in the book, even though it's incredibly famous. But then I did my due diligence on the play, and it ended up leading to, I think, the greatest discovery in this entire book, which is it's not the real catch that we're seeing on video. It's not the catch. It was a reproduction of the catch. They didn't get it on film. And of course, this is in 1947. So the newsreels are the thing. The games aren't on television or anything. The newsreels are the thing. And the newsreels did not get the catch. So they literally sent Al Gianfrido and a couple of other players out into the outfield before game 7 of the World Series. The crowd is going crazy. They make an announcement to the crowd, pretend like you're cheering for this thing. And then they just hit fly balls to Al Gianfrido, and he just kind of tried to reproduce the catch. And that is what we've been seeing all these years. And so it ended up being a moment that wasn't going to be in the book into, you know, maybe my favorite moment in the entire book.
That blew me away. I had no idea that the video was staged. This is one of those books that you can read straight through, or you can snack on it in sort of random bite-sized portions. And in that spirit, I'm going to bounce around a little bit with the material. Which brings me to not to Vladimir Guerrero Sr. or Jr., but to Vladimir Nabokov, by which I mean lepidopterism, specifically the occasionally sublime language of baseball. So you have a section on the knuckleball where you reference Hall of Famer Willie Stargell describing the pitch as, quote, a butterfly with hiccups, end quote. And later, in an item about Sandy Koufax's perfect game in 1965, you quote Dodgers broadcaster Vin Scully unspooling on-air gems like this one, quote, and there's 29,000 people in the ballpark and a million butterflies, end quote. When did you find yourself attracted to the language of baseball for the first time?
Ooh, good question. I think it had to be very young. I think, you know, and it wasn't necessarily even the poetry like you're talking about. I loved from my earliest memories, I loved some of the baseball slang, right? Like I didn't even know what it meant that a high fly ball was called a can of corn. That it didn't even like, why is it called a can of corn? And it wasn't until years later that I learned that it's because they used to keep cans of corn at the very top shelf at grocery stores. And what they would do is they would, with a stick, pull it off the shelf and catch it. Like just catch it for people in order to buy cans of corn. And so that's why a routine fly ball is called a can of corn. And then there's the Baltimore chop, which is just a ball hit right in front of home plate and bounces really, really high. And then somebody can beat it out for a single. And again, I loved that it was just called a Baltimore chop. I had no idea why. And then you find out it's because John McGraw, when he was playing in Baltimore, used to have the groundskeeper not water the area in front of home plate so that it got very, very hard. And then you would purposely chop the ball into the hard ground so it would be so high and you could beat out singles. So I've always been fascinated by the language of the game, and still am. But I also think, you know, I'm writing a football book. I'm writing a Why We Love and Hate Football, which is very, very different than baseball, as we know. And one of the things that strikes me is football is just not as interested in poetry and in history and in so many of the things that give baseball the qualities that make it so lovable. It's very interesting. It's really, I think, very specific to baseball, this wonderful language.
You write a lot in this book about how much our lives as fans are shaped by broadcasters, because that's how we see so much of this. And so I want to go through some of that with you. I want to start with a clip from 1995. This is Cal Ripken Jr., who, of course, played minor league baseball in Charlotte many, many years ago. Yes. This is when he played in his 2,131st consecutive game.
He clobbers it to deep left field. Go! Number 15 for Cal Ripken. He gives the Orioles a 3-1 lead as he hits a 3-0 pitch over the left field wall. And the fans want Cal to take a curtain call.
So that's Cal Ripken hitting the home run during his record-breaking game. What stands out to you about that night?
Oh, so much about that night. It's one of the strangest records in baseball history, in that all Cal Ripken really had to do that day was make it through five innings, right? Like that was that. Once he had done that, he had broken the record of most consecutive games ever played. So it's, you know, it was a moment, of course, in and of itself, but it was also, it's not a moment, it's an achievement. It's a lifetime thing. And him hitting the home run that day is what, I mean, it would have been an incredible day anyway, but him hitting the home run, just so perfect. It's such a perfect thing. And I love that call. And one of my favorite things about baseball calls is that it's a mixture of poetry and beauty, and also just telling you what just happened, right? It's like, oh, Cal Ripken hits a 3-0 pitch over the wall, which is not, there's nothing poetic about that, but it's just telling you the moment. And it's this wonderful mix. There's nothing, I don't think there's, I mean, there are great football announcers on the radio and basketball announcers on the radio, but no sport gives you the opportunity to be a storyteller and a play-by-play person and all the other things the way baseball does.
That is the voice of Joe Posnanski, and we're talking about why we love baseball. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guest today is sports writer and author Joe Posnanski. Joe lives here in Charlotte, and his new book is Why We Love Baseball, A History in 50 Moments. I should have mentioned, Joe, that Ripken's record-setting game, that's number 8 on your list, and of course, Cal Ripken's jersey number was number 8. I know that didn't pass you by, right?
Okay, let me tell you a quick story about this. So As we've talked about, my last book was The Baseball 100, which was a countdown of the greatest players in baseball history. And of course, Cal Ripken was one of those greatest players. And I was at the Hall of Fame about a year after the book came out. And I was there because my good friend and the subject of my first book, Buck O'Neill, was inducted into the Hall of Fame, which is one of the greatest moments of my life. And I went to, because it was Buck, I was invited to various parties. And one of the parties, Cal Ripken and his wife were there. And I started, I don't even remember how it happened, but his wife just started talking to me and she didn't know who I was or anything. And I said, oh, well, you know, I should definitely get you a copy of the book. Cal is in the Baseball 100. And she said, what number is he? And I said, I don't know off the top of my head. I know he's top, you know, 50. Is he one of the greatest players ever? And she's like, he should have been number 8. That's literally what she said to me. So all this time later, I am delivering for Cal Ripken's wife and making him number 8.
Very nice. Next up, number 40 on your list. And one of my favorite baseball memories, because I remember following this so closely as a middle schooler. This is George Brett of the Kansas City Royals hitting a tie-breaking home run at Yankee Stadium and having it overturned on a technicality.
They might be going to call George Brett out.
Well, he is. He's out.
Yes, sir.
Brett is out. Look at this. Brett is out.
And he's steaming mad.
He is out and having to be forcibly restrained from hitting plate umpire Tim McClellan. And the Yankees have won the ball game 4-3. Brett is called out for using an illegal bat or with the illegal substance on the bat.
But Joe, this is the kind of, it's kind of the hanging chad of baseball moments here. Take us through what happened and how this was ultimately resolved.
I love that he has to be forcibly removed. That's just such a perfect wording for either George Brett attacking the umpire or like some fan going on the field. So this is a Yankees Red Sox game, Yankees Royals game, excuse me. And it's in 19, there's already a huge history, it should be said. This is 83, but there's a huge history not only between the Yankees and Royals, who had played each other several times in the ALCS, American League Championship Series, but also a huge, huge rivalry between the pitcher, Goose Gossage, and the hitter, George Brett. And the game is in the ninth inning, and George Brett, Goose Gossage says, who was one of the hardest throwers ever, says he was aiming for George's neck. And somehow George Brett not only got out of the way, but he hit a home run to give the Royals the lead. And the Yankees manager at the time was Billy Martin. And Billy Martin raced on the field and said, that's an illegal bat. And the reason they said it was an illegal bat is because at that time, and this rule has been changed, but at that time, you could only have pine tar on the bat at a certain height of the bat. And Brett's bat was loaded up with pine tar way, way above the limit. And so they measured the bat and very kind of famously, the umpire measured the bat by putting it across home plate to see if it was a legal bat.
I love that moment. I went back and watched the video. It's just great.
Go ahead. It's so fun the way that they sort of dramatically put the bat across, like they knew home plate was 17 inches long and they're like, all right, let's see if this is long enough. And then the umpire pointed at Brett and said, you're out, because the bat was clearly illegal. And Brett loses his mind. I mean, it's one of the great things. And I worked in Kansas City for many years and became good friends with George. And I've heard George tell the story many times. And he lost his mind. He just went crazy and raced out there and looked like he was going to attack the umpire and had to be restrained and forcibly removed and all of that. And then the whole story is so wonderful and amazing. The umpire's got the call wrong. That's the craziest part of all. The bat was illegal, but it was not illegal in the sense of that pine tar made the bat, you know, you could hit with more power or something. It just, the reason the rule ever existed is because some cheap owners did not want the bat to have pine tar high enough that it was ruining baseballs. They were trying to save baseballs. And so it was just a cost-saving measure. So, yes, if Billy Martin had run on the field and said that's an illegal bat, they would have made George change the bat. That was the rule. The rule was not if you use a pine tar bat, you're out. That was not the rule. So they actually overruled one of the rare cases in baseball history where they overruled the umpire, let the home run count, and then they all came back and played in a crazy, like, 20-minute, 15-minute, like, end-of-game thing at Yankee Stadium. And it's a wonderful, wonderful scene and one of my favorite moments in the book.
And the Royals ended up winning the game.
They did.
They got the home run back. So now moving into the 1990s, this is number 44 on your list. Here is a less than fearsome hitter named Francisco Cabrera driving in a wobbly Sid Bream to send the Atlanta Braves to the World Series.
He hacked at the 2-0, now the 2-1. Line drive and a base hit! Just as the score of the tying run, Bream to the plate! And he is saved! Saved at the plate! The Braves go to the World Series! The unlikeliest of heroes wins the National League Championship Series for the Atlanta Braves. Francisco Cabrera, and Atlanta pulls out Game 7 with 3 runs in the bottom of the ninth inning.
Now, Joe, you know you're living in Braves country, so there are a lot of people listening to this that are just clapping in their cars, reliving the glory. I think you covered this as a young sports writer. If I'm correct about that, what do you remember about being at the ballpark that night?
Oh, it was incredible. I was working for the Augusta Chronicle that day, and I was there. It was my first ever, you know, I mean, I had not been to many big games in my life. I was 23 years old. And what I remember, there are a couple of things that really stand out in my mind that I write about. One is I remember how fans were leaving the game. They just were pouring out of the stadium because they were losing. Braves were losing going into the ninth inning, getting shut out by Pittsburgh's Doug Drabeck, and it was hopeless. The game was over, and you know, I think a lot of Braves fans were like, "Ah, that's a shame," but you know, it's a really good season. You know, the Braves used to be absolutely terrible, and suddenly they were, you know, good, and all of that. And then, of course, the buildup and the comeback. You know, I'm very, very proud and happy to say that one of the people who helped me write that chapter, who had his own little section, is WFAE's own Tommy Tomlinson, one of my closest friends. And he actually writes about that call that we just heard and how it, you know, gives him goosebumps every time he hears it. And you know, as a huge Atlanta Braves fan, it was chaos. It was just absolute chaos. And I write about this in the book, and it's hard to sort of, like, in the book, it's easier to sort of explain. That moment in many ways stands alone in baseball history because it is the only moment that I could find where every single thing was on the line in that one pitch. Like, that was because if he makes out, the Pirates go to the World Series. If he gets the hit, obviously Sid Bream has to try to score. If he's out at the plate, the Pirates go to the World Series. If he's safe at the plate, the Braves go to the World Series. And all the other great moments, I mean, that you can think of, there was one out, or it was not a game seven, or it was, you know, like, this was one crescendo of every single thing coming to one moment. And I love that so much.
Now, this is a less appetizing thought for Braves fans, which is the New York Yankees, particularly 1996. That's off limits. We're not, thank God you didn't include Jim Leyritz's home run off Mark Wohlers.
No.
But here's your book's 23rd greatest moment, which features Derek Jeter, Mr. November, in the 2001 World Series.
For the first time in the history of Major League Baseball, playing the World Series during the month of November, and for very good reason. Everything pushed back 1 week after September the 11th, pushing the postseason back and now officially into November as Derek Jeter bats with two out and nobody on. Jeter hits it into right. Back at the wall. Game over. Yankees win and the series is tied.
That is Joe Buck calling Derek Jeter's Mr. November home run. One of the things that I thought was interesting about that section that you wrote about, Joe, is that a lot of people forget The Yankees went on and lost Game 7 to the Arizona Diamondbacks. And it's a phenomenon that's similar to what you write about Carlton Fisk in 1975 right. with the famous walk-off homer for the Red Sox. How do you think these home runs came to overshadow everything else about those World Series?
So it's a great question. I think the Fisk home run is just because that game was so epic, right? Game 6 was so epic. So many things happened in Game 6 of the 1975 World Series. Fisk's home run wasn't even the sort of most pivotal home run of the game. I think Bernie Carbo's home run that tied the game up was even more epic. But Fisk's, it's such an iconic moment, him hitting the home run and jumping up and down as he, you know, runs to first base, trying to wave the ball fair. And I think Jeter's home run for the same thing. I was there, as I write about in the chapter, and it remains the most emotional baseball moment of my life. It's hard to sort of recapture what America was like right then. I mean, there was still smoke coming off of Ground Zero at that moment. November 1st, everywhere we're feeling it, but particularly in New York. And the game was so incredible. The Yankees looked like they were dead in the ninth inning, and Tino Martinez hits a two-run home run to tie the game with two outs, and the crowd is just unlike any crowd I've ever been around. And then when he hits the home run, the emotion that spilled out was unlike anything I've ever seen. People just they started playing Frank Sinatra's New York, New York, and people sang along, 50,000 people singing. And then the song ends and they started again and they're still singing, and they played it over and over and over again with the crowd singing. And I'm no Yankees lover, as I talk about quite a bit in the book, but I've never seen anything like that, been around anything like that. Being in the middle, I was sitting in the right field stands. That's where the auxiliary press box was. And I was sitting in the stands surrounded by all of these people crying and hugging and singing. It was magical. And you know, the fact the Yankees actually lost on a very critical, crucial play on a broken bat single off of Mariano Rivera. So, I mean, there's a very famous ending to that series, but that Jeter home run will live forever.
And you're right. Look, I was far from it. I was watching here in Charlotte, and I've never been a Yankee fan. I don't like the Yankees. But that month or so, you couldn't help but fall in love right. with the Yankees. It was just, I don't know, it felt almost like comfort food. The New York yeah. Yankees are playing baseball on TV, and we all felt good about that. By the way, that stopped after a couple of seasons.
But... yeah, they got 1 month. Yeah. That's all.
Yeah, they got a month or something, and that was it. Number 39 in your book is an item that I think will be new to most readers. It certainly was to me. It came from a game in 1968 in Japan involving pitcher, and you'll have to correct me on pronunciation, Yutaka Inatsu.
Yeah, that's right.
And the great slugger Sadahara Oh. What happened in Hyogo Prefecture that day?
Oh, it's I love this story so much. So Yutaka Inatsu was the greatest pitcher in Japanese baseball at the time. And in 1968, he was a strong left-hander, a lot like Koufax. Players who played with both Yutaka Inatsu and Sandy Koufax would say that they were identical in many ways. And that year, Yutaka Inatsu was going to break the strikeout record in Japan. He ended up setting a record that still has not been broken, over 400 strikeouts. But he was also a very flamboyant guy. And particularly in Japanese baseball, where so much of it is about staying in the background and being a part of a team, he really stood out as this sort of larger-than-life figure. And he announces to everybody that not only is he going to break the strikeout record, he's going to break it by striking out the greatest baseball player in history of Japan, Sadaharu Oh. It's not enough to just break the strikeout record. He's going to break it by striking out Sadaharu Oh. And so the game comes where he's in position to break the record. He has to strike out six or seven batters. And sure enough, Sadaharu Oh comes up and he strikes him out to break the record. And then he goes back into the dugout. At least this is the version I like. There are other versions of the story, but this is the version I like, where he goes back to the dugout and everybody's cheering. And then somebody says to him, you didn't break the record. You only tied the record. And he goes, okay. And he announces to his players that he was going to let the next eight batters hit the ball so that he could still strike out Sadaharu Oh to set the record, which he promptly goes out and does. He literally lets eight consecutive batters hit the ball. He purposely puts the ball over the plate where they can hit it so that he can strike out Sadaharu Oh, which he does to break the record. I could not love that. That could have been the number one moment. Is how much I love that moment.
It's fantastic. I'm curious, did you know about that moment for a long time, or had you just discovered it recently?
I totally discovered it. In fact, there's a different Yutaka Inatsu moment that I talk about a little bit in the book, but that was my original moment. He actually threw a no-hitter for 11 innings and the game kept scoreless, and he just kept going and going and going. And finally he said, enough of this, I'm going to end this. And he went out and hit a home run to win his own no-hitter, which is just, and so that was my moment. And as I was researching him, I came across this other moment, and I love both moments so much. And I actually had a dinner with some friends who are a couple of them are big baseball fans. One of them is sort of a very moderate one. And I actually said, hey, here are the two moments. You tell me which one is the right moment for the book. And they all agreed that it was letting eight batters hit so that he could strike out Sadaharu Oh for the record.
Incredible. This is the right moment for us to take one more break. Stay with us. We're going to have a lot more with Joe Posnanski on why we love baseball. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. My guest today is sports writer Joe Posnanski, who lives here in Charlotte and whose latest book, Why We Love Baseball, A History in 50 Moments, has just been published. Now, Joe, you grew up in Cleveland, and yet you love baseball anyway. you describe Cleveland Municipal Stadium, which, of course, is the predecessor to the current ballpark, as, quote, a mausoleum that smelled of stale beer and broken dreams, end quote. I'm curious, did you spend much time at the ballpark growing up?
Well, we couldn't afford to go as often as I would have liked, but once a year at least, sometimes twice a year, my father would take, usually for a doubleheader. He was all about the bargains. we would go out to the ballpark on Sundays when he wasn't working. And so I feel like I spent a lot of time there. I can tell you that I you know, this was before we moved to Charlotte. And I can tell you that I probably went to, I don't know, 15, 20 games, maybe not that many, maybe more, but somewhere in that range. And I never sat in a seat that wasn't blocked by a steel girder. And there was nobody there. The place was tiny and there was nobody there. But you mentioned earlier that about Cal Ripken playing in Charlotte. Mm-hmm. I moved to Charlotte just after Cal Ripken played, the year after
that.
Cal
really? Ripken
played. Yeah. So, so I went to high school in Charlotte, and so I used to go to the old Crockett Park, you know, before it burned down. And I can remember, like, there was still this sort of buzz about Cal Ripken having played there. And, you know, they still had some stars, and I covered the the Charlotte O's when Tom Dodd was starring and all of that. So I have such great memories. So when I think about like being young, I think about being at Cleveland Municipal Stadium, and almost as much I think about being at Old Crockett Park, because I went to many more games. Like I would go fairly often with my buddy Rob to Charlotte O's games at the time, and of course later followed them and covered the very first rendition of the Charlotte Knights in Rock Hill and Fort Mill rather. So Charlotte baseball actually is really important to me.
Doug, big part of your love of the game. You mentioned there are a lot of home runs in this book, but for a very good reason. This is a little spoiler alert. Braves fans are going to be really happy with the number one moment in your book, and here it is.
He's sitting on 714. Here's the pitch by Downing. Swinging. There's a drive into left center field. That ball is going to be out of here. It's gone. It's 7:15. There's a new home run champion of all time, and it's Henry Aaron.
That's Milo Hamilton on the call in April 1974 when Aaron broke Babe Ruth's career home run record. But you write in the book that a notable aspect of Milo's call is that he says Henry and not Hank. How come? Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't say he didn't like being called Hank Aaron. That's probably overstating it some. He knew only baseball people called him Hank Aaron. Everybody else, all his friends, his family, people who knew him, called him Henry. And he would always know if somebody like said, "Hey, Hank," that was somebody he didn't know. That was somebody. So I love that the great respect that Milo Hamilton had. He was like, it wasn't just, there's a new home run champion of all time. It's Henry Aaron. You know, this is somebody we know. This is somebody who is important to us. And it's a very, it's a very interesting thing that I went through when I was trying to think of what the greatest moment in baseball history is. And because there is an obvious number one. I mean, like if you're just doing the book and you're not, you know, you're just like, hey, I want to do this without getting in any arguments or anything else. this is the number one is obviously Jackie Robinson. Yeah. And there's no arguments to be made if you put Jackie Robinson at number one. I just kept coming around to a bunch of different ideas. One of those ideas, as I write a lot about in this book, is I kind of feel like Jackie Robinson's moment has been, it's not been corrupted. That's too much. It's not been fully embraced for what it was. We celebrate Jackie Robinson, and we should. And he was the most important figure in baseball history in my mind. But the story only begins with Jackie Robinson, and if it had only been Jackie Robinson, then what is it? You know, what is the story? And it feels like because Jackie Robinson was such a titanic figure, we have lost sort of the stories of Larry Doby, who was the second African-American to play. The story of Roy Campanella, who was the first catcher, and the stories of Don Newcomb, who was the first really dominant African-American pitcher, and the stories of Monty Irvin, who was, you know, a great player in the Negro Leagues and then well past his prime went to the major leagues and was a great player even then. And so on for not just a year or 2 years, but for decades, the story continues on and on and on all the way to Frank Robinson becoming the first African-American manager, 1975. So 28 years later. And so I think that's the whole story is what did Jackie Robinson did is incredible, but what did it lead to? And what it led to in my mind is the greatest moment in baseball history, which is Henry Aaron through enduring terrible, terrible things on his way, breaking the record of the most iconic figure in the history of not just baseball, but American sports, Babe Ruth, and you know, running the bases that day, and Milo Hamilton's call, and all of it. It's to me the greatest moment in baseball history.
Well, and it's interesting, Joe. We played, obviously, Milo Hamilton's call, of course, because Vin Scully has been a part of everything that's happened in baseball history. It seems like he probably was calling Babe Ruth's games and we just didn't know it. So they were playing the Dodgers that night, and there is a companion call, of course, with Vin Scully. And Vin Scully says during the home run trot, he says, a black man in the deep South breaking this record. He says it much more eloquently because he's Vin Scully, but tying all those things together, the legacy of Jackie Robinson, African-Americans and integration into the game. And so I think you have a strong case, and that's not just Braves bias speaking, but I, you know, objectively, when you look at the lineage of the game and the way Henry Aaron carried himself, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I mean, and Henry Aaron was very, very, he talked all the time about how life-changing it was, not only when Jackie Robinson played in the major league, giving him a dream that days earlier was non-existent, essentially. But meeting Jackie Robinson as a young man and seeing him in Alabama and what that meant to him and how much Jackie Robinson's sort of courage and will carried him through all of those terrible moments that he had to endure on the way when he was getting hate mail and threats and you know, his kids couldn't even go to school without bodyguards and all of these things that were very much a part of America at the time. He endured those things, and he endured them in large part because he felt like he was the next step in the journey of Jackie Robinson. And Jackie Robinson did not live to see his moment, which he always regretted. He'd only died only, you know, just 3 years before. But it was, Jackie Robinson was very much on his shoulder throughout. So to me, moments number two and number one sort of carry through all the way through.
It's also interesting that, of course, Henry Aaron and Babe Ruth are linked inextricably, and the called shot, the controversy about whether, yes, Babe Ruth called the home run in the 1932 World Series at Wrigley Field. You seem to, that's one of your greatest moments, and you seem to have solved it, but solved it through the deductive work of a former Marine. Give us a little flavor of how you found this gentleman, or found his work anyway, on that called shot.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's funny. I really, there was such a fun challenge in this book. There are moments that we have talked about, and many, many more that have not been written about. They've just not been written at all about. And so that's a pretty much a blank canvas, right? I can write anything. Then there are very famous moments in this book that have been written about a million different ways. And it's sort of like, how do you tell the story in a different way? Mm-hmm. So nothing has been written about more than Babe Ruth's called shot. It is the ultimate moment in baseball history. And so I wanted to figure out ways to write about it. And of course, one of the things that I really wanted to explore, and I tried to explore this a lot in the book, is sort of that, where is the myth end and the reality begin, right? Because there's so much mythology around the called shot. And I wrote that and was, you know, wrote about all these different things and found, you know, some new, fairly new material. And then somebody writes to me just kind of out of nowhere, saying, you know, I see you're writing a book about baseball moments. I'm sure you're writing about the call shot. It turns out that I've been, that has been sort of like one of the obsessions of my life has been the call shot. And I actually wrote to the pitcher who gave up the home run. And I, if you want, I can send you the letter. So I said, of course I do. Of course I want that. So he sends me this letter of the pitcher who gives up the called shot. And basically he was young then. He was a kid. And he wrote, I just want to know, did Babe Ruth call his shot? And the pitcher responds beautifully, if he had pointed before, I would have put him on his butt. Like I would never have pitched to him. And then, but it gets even better because the person who wrote to me also wrote to the daughter of the pitcher who gave up the home run. And he wrote to her, and she was an older woman by the time this was later in his life. And he wrote to her, and she wrote like a whole sort of story about being at that game and what it was like. And she goes and she, you know, talks about how amazing it was and this and that and the other, but she insists that he definitely did not call the shot, because if he had, her father would have put him on his butt. Like this was apparently a whole family thing. So, but there's so many wonderful myths and stories. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt was there, and future Supreme Court justice was there. And it's really that, there's nothing richer, I think, than the whole story of Babe Ruth's called shot.
I have to mention one last home run, and it's really more about your description of the home run than the home run itself. And that is Bo Jackson hitting a dinger off of Nolan Ryan in 1989. And here's how you describe it. Quote, when the bat connected with the ball, the sound was like the liberation of Paris, end quote. So I know you covered the Royals for many years. Were you at that game?
I was not. This was before I was in Kansas City. But that shot, I'm glad you brought up that moment. I don't know how often I'll talk about it. That was the first moment in the book. That was the very first moment. That was the moment that I actually, when I reached out to the publishing house and said, hey, I want to write this book, that was the moment I wrote about. I just, because I loved the clash between the hardest thrower who ever lived and sort of the most legendary, iconic player who ever lived, who, by the way, hit his first professional home run here in Charlotte, Bo Jackson. I was at that game. And I just love the clash between the two. And of course, most of the time, Nolan Ryan won. Nolan Ryan struck him out like 10 times in a row or something. But this one time, it's like this cosmic connection of Bo swinging. He always swung as hard as he could. And Nolan Ryan trying to throw his best fastball, and what the connection was like. It's incredible.
And Joe, as you know, having lived here, it is mandatory when we speak of baseball that we speculate on whether Major League Baseball will ever come to Charlotte. So as we bring it into contemporary times from all the great memories, what's your feeling on whether MLB will ever make its way to Charlotte?
Well, it's something I don't see a direct path, because I don't see a direct path really for anywhere, right? It's like there are 30 teams now, and you know, they're still trying to figure out what to do with Oakland. Maybe it looks like they're going to Las Vegas, but maybe they won't. Tampa Bay is kind of a mess. Nobody really knows what to do there. Miami is kind of a mess. Nobody really knows what to do there. So there are a lot of different sort of moving parts. And there are cities like Nashville that seem to be more aggressive than Charlotte is being. But I tell people this all the time, because when I first moved to Charlotte, there was nothing. There were no Panthers, no Hornets, no anything, no professional sports. And at the time, Charlotte, of course, was growing so rapidly. People were saying, do you think professional sports could work here, and so on? And I actually covered when George Shinn made the first presentation to try to bring baseball to Charlotte. And there was just this feeling like, Charlotte's not quite big enough, and Atlanta so close, and this and that, and the other. I don't buy that. I really believe that if Major League Baseball did come to Charlotte, it would be really successful. I think that this, especially if you had a downtown park and everything else, that this is, one, Charlotte is such a wonderful place, but two, Charlotte revolves, I think, around these kinds of things. And if there was a nightly, you know, ball game, I mean, there already is with the Knights, which are great, great fun, and we're season ticket holders and love it so much. But if there was Major League Baseball in town, I think it would be big. I think it would be huge here. I think it would probably be huge in Nashville. I mean, like I say, they're probably a little ahead of us, but I think the South is underrepresented in Major League Baseball, and I think Charlotte would work. I just don't know where Charlotte is in line right now, if that makes sense.
So we'll leave it on the cliffhanger. Joe, I want to thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
That's Joe Posnanski. His new book is Why We Love Baseball. For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks so much for listening to Charlotte Talks.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.